Hello and welcome to the Religion Media Centre podcast. I'm Ruth Peacock and this week I'm hosting a discussion on the 10th anniversary of the enthronement of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Our panel reviews this turbulent decade and assesses his contribution. Welcome to this week's Religion Media Centre briefing, which is on the 10th anniversary of Justin Welby's enthronement as the Archbishop of Canterbury, and what a turbulent decade it has turned out to be. Helping us to make sense of it all today, we have Dr. Andrew Atherstone, author and tutor in church history and doctrine at Wycliffe Hall, the University of Oxford. Paul Bayes, the former Bishop of Liverpool. The Reverend Professor Alison Milbank, the University of Nottingham, but also on the steering committee of Save the Parish. Professor Helen King, member of the General Synod and on the Living in Love and Faith project team. And Canon Dr. Anderson Jeremiah, University of Lancaster and member of the Archbishop's Committee for Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns. So I think we've got all bases covered there. And first of all, I wonder if I could ask each member of the panel just for a headline, just a 30-second headline. As you look back on these 10 years with Justin Welby at the helm, how do you remember them? What are the headlines for you? Perhaps Helen King, if I could ask you first of all.
Thank you. Yeah, for me personally, it's been the decade of living in love and faith, because it was shortly after Justin Welby became Archbishop that the beginnings of that happened with the shared conversations. So for me, it's been sexuality that's been the dominant theme. And also alongside that, sexual abuse. The two are to me absolutely intertwined in the Church of England. And I knew nothing about sexual abuse before this decade started. And now I know far more than I really wish to know. We're still trying to deal with that.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson Jeremiah in Lancaster, how do you look back at the last 10 years?
The first time I got to know about Justin was when the war on Wonga.com was launched. You know, that pretty much set the tone in terms of taking on the public and the financial institutions. And of course, later on, we also got to know more robustly with his engagement with racial justice issues that has become pretty pertinent. And of course, much of the discussions and debates that the Archbishop brought to the conversation is a kind of a fearless engagement with the public domain. Some things he got it wrong, sometimes he got it right, but that fearlessness of engaging with the public space is something that I would consider very important.
Thank you. And Bishop Paul Bayes, you just retired from being Bishop of Liverpool. How do you look back on the last 10 years?
Thank you. I think it's been the trajectory of the church has not changed since the previous 10 years. The England is changing very quickly, and the Church of England is doing its best to get to grips with that. Justin Welby set three priorities for his own ministry: prayer, reconciliation, and evangelism. And I think in each of those, he's made progress. He's given himself a particular way of working. People say that the job of the Archbishop of Canterbury is an impossible job, and that's quite right. But one thing you can do when you begin as Archbishop is decide which impossible job you want to do. And I think this Archbishop has chosen the impossible job of holding the Anglican Communion together, and he's chosen the impossible job of trying to please everyone within the Church of England. That has not proved easy. In fact, it's been impossible. And there's been an opportunity cost in terms of the way in which he's been able to speak to England, and also in terms of his own subjectivity. Like every other archbishop, he's sometimes not felt able to tell us what he thinks. He's by no means unique in that, but that has been one way in which the impact of the role on him personally has been seen by all of us.
Thank you, Bishop. Professor Alison Milbank, you're on the Save the Parish Steering Committee. What's your headline from the last 10 years?
I chair the welcome for the Archbishop's fearlessness in the public sphere, and particularly I value his heart for the poor. In terms of the institution of the church, the headline for me would be that of centralization, increasing, moving away from a dispersed authority to the power of the Archbishop's Council, and particularly the policies put in place for vision and strategy, which has never been debated in synod or discussed in the diocese, but has had catastrophic and will have catastrophic implications for the parish system.
Thanks. We're going to obviously come back to that as one of the areas of discussion a bit later. Perhaps, Bishop, I could start the areas of questioning with you and talk about church membership. You mentioned that England was changing very quickly. And just a look at the figures, that the number of people attending worship on a Sunday has gone down from 1.1 million in 2009 to 605,000 in 2021, more or less a halving. And he has been the leader of the church and witnessed that happening. Was there anything more that he could have done as the top leader of the Church of England to have changed that trajectory, do you think?
I mean, I think within the last 10 years, the big, as far as attendance is concerned, the big thing that happened was the COVID pandemic. And in that pandemic, quick decisions had to be made by the Archbishop and by the bishops more generally. And they took decisions concerning, in particular, the openness of churches for prayer and the openness of churches for prayer by the clergy, and those decisions were taken and followed through, and the Archbishop has taken quite a lot of stick for those decisions. They may or may not have been the right decisions, but the blow that they struck, that the pandemic struck to church attendance, is universal across the churches in this country, and has been radical. But before that, there was a steady but marked a decline in the numbers of people worshipping year on year, not nearly so quick as the pandemic, but certainly marked. And I think that's why one of the Archbishop's three priorities was evangelism, and I think he has tried to use his own role and to use his power of convening to bring people together to talk more about how we can grow the church. In Liverpool, where the Archbishop was dean before he became Bishop of Durham and then Archbishop, in Liverpool we had a purpose for the diocese, which was to ask God for a bigger church to make a bigger difference. We asked God, because God is the one who can give us everything. The bigger church and the bigger difference were linked together, and I think that the decline in all the churches, partly, primarily as a result of the pandemic, is not because of a faithlessness in the people of God, but because there's a rapidly changing culture to which we have sometimes wisely and sometimes unwisely into which we have spoken. And I think the record of the Archbishop in terms of numbers should not be focused on the reality of the pandemic, which has had such a radical effect across the churches.
One of the solutions, though, that he found, I don't know whether Dr. Anderson Jeremiah, you'd like to come back at this point, this idea of evangelism going outside church structures and church planting in community centres or wherever people would gather together. How significant was that? How successful was it? And was that appropriate for the Church of England?
I fully take what Bishop Paul said. I think what Archbishop Justin did is, I think, to a large extent, his kind of secular world experience, he brought it into bear within the life of the church. Very often, that meant that kind of not doing the way the church has worked for centuries before. And that definitely bringing in a global perspective, again, an experience that he brings from working abroad, and bringing a more wider Anglican communion perspective into bear within the Church of England was very important in shaping how evangelism and discipleship and all these issues were discussed. So, and definitely his own kind of church tradition, so to speak, had a very big impact on how that was shaped, trying to understand and respond to a very changing religious landscape within England. And that's very important. I think it is not just Church of England that was undergoing change, but the very religious landscape of England was undergoing a radical change. Therefore, in many ways, I think he was responding from his own experience and also respond appropriately from an objective point of view. And I think from that point, it's very important to distinguish what he accomplished and what he is instigating.
Perhaps I could go to you now, Professor Milbank, because there has been criticism of the tactic strategy shown in expanding the church beyond the structures of the Church of England. With the new places having ministers who or pastors who haven't gone through the training, with church organisation that doesn't grow out of any experience. And I'm wondering whether you feel that this was a step too far, this initiative was a step too far.
I take the point that the religious landscape has changed and that we need to respond to it. What seemed to me bizarre was the idea that you would respond to it, not working outwards from your core activity, but setting up this parallel system, a kind of competitive system. So, for example, in Rochdale, you spend millions on an ex-Chinese restaurant, 3 minutes walk from the parish church, where you lavish clergy and resources, while 2.5 miles up the road is a kind of council estate where they are starting a kind of pioneer minister, but with nothing like the kind of resources that being kind of lavished on the centre. Is almost as if you say the resource church for the middle class and the pioneer minister sort of doing their own thing for the social housing. I find the whole thing incoherent because it doesn't start from the core activity. In fact, it puts it in competition. So you've got 10,000 new worshipping communities, 10,480 parishes, but they are not connected in their thinking. The whole idea is that you separate these out, and it's almost as if they think of the parish as belonging to the past and having no value. Almost as if you're sort of saying, we're the co-op, let's set up Tesco's. And yes, that would increase choice, sure, but it's kind of doing the co-op. So I take the point that we need to evangelize, but I feel our evangelism should be joined up and work from our core activity. And everything in the vision and strategy way of doing things is very much like what Dr. Jeremiah pointed out, is the mixed economy model of, you know, public, private, competitive tendering and so on.
Professor King, can I ask for your observation on that? Do you agree that this, do you have concerns about this form of mission?
Yes, I do. And I feel there's a real lack of grasping reality that's going on here. Particularly, one of the things I serve on is Ministry Council, and we're talking there about this plan to have 3,000 paid youth and families workers and 30,000 assorted youth and families workers, and all these new communities, new fresh expressions of church. And where is the funding supposed to come from for that, particularly post-COVID? As Alison says, most of the money is going into a very small number of projects. If you look at how many people, how many new disciples, whatever you measure that by, are being created by each one, it's a very, very small number. Yet, the basic work of the church, the parishes, is not being properly resourced. And I do think it's an issue. We have all these big plans for growing the church, but a very serious lack of real engagement with how those are going to be funded. A lot of what happens in the Church of England feels very distant from your average parish. And I mean your average parish. You're slightly larger than an average parish, I suppose. But really, these plans, they don't match with what we're doing, and they don't match with what we need.
I'm wondering how much of a surprise this was to all of you, really. He was a, well, he is, charismatic evangelical, associated with Holy Trinity Brompton. You know, in a sense, perhaps the church should have expected some, you know, whiz-bang evangelism, a strategy like the one that emerged. And yet, at the end of the 10 years, we have the Church of England Evangelical Council saying that it's going to resist the changes within the Church of the Blessings of same-sex marriage, talking about alternative oversight. I don't know who'd like to come back on that, Bishop. I wonder if this is one for you. How has it come to that, that the man who was kind of the standard bearer for evangelicalism has presided over a situation where the evangelicals are talking about withdrawing?
Yeah, the word evangelical is a big word that covers a very broad church, and there are those on the General Synod and elsewhere who wish that their own definition of the word evangelical would be universally agreed. And so when you say that the evangelicals are thinking of withdrawing, that there are, of course, a number of people who own that title and who are hacked off with the church because of decisions that have been made around same-sex relationships. But they do not sum up or define the evangelical world more generally. The Archbishop came in with evangelism as one of his three priorities. It was my privilege to serve as vice chair on the Archbishop's task force for evangelism for some years, and I can testify that he had, as his own parish experience makes clear, he had a lived experience of the inherited church. Which does not mean that he is, as it were, in the pocket of those who are putting money into the national coffers in order to produce new ways of being the church. In Liverpool, we had 200 clergy, 240 parishes. We had one or two resource churches. They were resourced by definition from the national church, not from the diocese. And the way in which the Church of England is funded does not have to do with the General Synod deciding where money should go. Almost all the levers of finance are held within the dioceses. And certainly it did not, I don't recognize this diminishment of the parish or this sense in which the national church is showing contempt for the parish. I don't recognize that in the dioceses. Almost all the work I did as a serving bishop was with the inherited parishes, chaplaincies, and schools. And I think this other stuff can be laid alongside it to enrich. In Liverpool City, those two or three resource churches are attracting hundreds of young people, and that's really good. They would not have gone to Evensong down the road. The sense in which a fast-changing England needs a responsive church is something with which I would identify, but I don't see the zero-sum game that Alison has portrayed, and I hope that it won't come to that.
One thing I found very striking in the last 10 years is I've now realised the difference between different types of evangelical. I went to an evangelical Sunday school myself, a gathered church, i.e. a church that's not really a parish church, but took people from all over the area. And then I moved into my parish church, and I've been in parish churches since. But for evangelicals, it does seem to be quite a strong line now between the conservative evangelicals who are saying enough is enough and we need to leave, and the rest of the evangelicals who are saying we don't have a problem if our bishop doesn't think the same way as we do. That's just not it, really. And something I've learned is that the conservative evangelicals, with their very strong emphasis on the Bible, of course, and on a particular way of reading the Bible, are different from some of the other evangelicals in more the Holy Trinity Brompton area of things, where there's a much stronger charismatic strand. And of course, Justin Welby himself is from the charismatic background, and that the charismatics are more interested in accepting that there is emotion plays a part, that there is a greater freedom in what they might do because of that, that the Spirit leads them in a way that maybe leads them beyond a biblical model into something new. And I think one of the big things that's come out of this last 10 years is that distinction. The Holy Trinity Brompton type of evangelicals can be much more willing to change because they're inspired by the Spirit and they believe the Spirit moves now. The conservatives may be less likely to change. I don't know if that's helpful in a way, as a way of thinking about this.
Is this what you gleaned from your work with Living in Love and Faith, Helen, when you were, because you said at the beginning that for you this was the defining feature over the last 10 years, the discussion over sexual ethics. Did you find that in the process of Living in Love and Faith, this was one of the outcomes, that there was more tension within the groups, a more variety of views?
Well, I think Andrew and I were both in the history group, and we found that a very friendly group where we had different views and we respected each other as professional historians, so no problem. It became more problematic in the larger groups. And I think sexuality as the big issue has really surprised me in many ways. When we started this, before even Living in Love and Faith, we had the shared conversations. And there the emphasis was on different ways of reading the Bible. Let's accept that different types of Christian read the Bible differently. And actually that historically people have read the Bible in many ways as allegorical, as a rule book, as a series of different books in dialogue, a series of voices, a gradual revelation. There are different ways of reading the Bible. And I thought once we put that one out there as this is where the differences in our views on sexuality come from, that it would all be much easier to talk to each other. It hasn't been. It's just like we go round and round the same debates over and over again, the same Bible verses, which, you know, are difficult to translate, have been interpreted differently over time, all that. So the Bible, I thought, was going to be the answer to this, different ways of reading it. And actually, it doesn't seem to have worked like that. There's also been a lot there about, about the relationship between the church and the world. So is the church a sort of refuge from the world, or is the church part of the world? The world is God's world. Do we resist the world, or do we listen to the world? And that seems to me a really important issue that has come out in the last 10 years.
Do you think that the whole scheme was perhaps too ambitious, or that the issues that you discovered weren't appreciated at the start, which is why essentially it failed, because it was meant to bring the church together, wasn't it? And in the end, everyone's just splitting apart.
It was meant to bring the church together, but if you look at the parishes who did or who didn't do the course, the Living in Love and Faith course, some didn't do it because they regarded it as just, you know, an evil product of the world, that you couldn't discuss sexuality unless you discussed it in a particular way and foregrounded a certain biblical verses. Others didn't do it because they didn't really wish to engage with it, because frankly it was irrelevant to the problems they were facing. I don't know. At the beginning, a lot of people said it was just kicking the can down the road, you know, leaving it all in the long grass, the usual sorts of images people have. And the trouble is now it really does look like we have wasted those years and a lot of money, if we're talking about resources, a lot of money for the shared conversations and Living in Love and Faith.
I'm not sure that the time has been wasted. I think what has emerged is that there are irreconcilable differences. We could have predicted that, but on the other hand, we needed to walk down that road before we could work out quite how unreconcilable those differences are. The Archbishop's desire to hold together the World Communion is commendable, but the opportunity cost for that is that within England, the Church seems to be squabbling about things which the overwhelming majority of people in the nation, across the political spectrum, except for the newly hatched extreme right wing parties, have simply accepted as a done deal, namely the equality of people in marriage and in relationships, no matter what their sexual orientation. So the Church has come has seemed to be chasing its own tail in this irrelevant way, which is a pity from the point of view of mission. But to have gone down that road and now to have found a minority, but a loud minority of the Church saying, if we move one more step, we're leaving. In a sense, that simply reveals the reality with which the Archbishop or his successor or the rest of us over the next 10 years will simply have to cope. The attempts have been made to bring about some kind of political compromise. And I think that that will not be successful. I may be mistaken. Certainly, the present Archbishop has great skill in trying to bring together those of different view. That's his reconciliation background. But in this case, I think the task is rapidly proving to be impossible, and intransigence is emerging. But at least the Archbishop can't say that he didn't give it his best shot.
I think it's very important to put this in perspective. I think one of the first things that Archbishop Justin did was to get the women into the episcopate within the Church of England. I think that was one of the first things that he was able to navigate. And that points to more consistency in his character in terms of grappling with some of the very difficult, divisive issues. And he's not afraid to step into those spaces simply because of his belief in reconciliation. As someone who has worked with him as one of his theological advisory group, I could see his passion to bring different groups of people in the same room. And this is where I see the work of LLF, I think, is very symptomatic of the life of the church in the last 2,000 years. I think it takes individuals in leadership positions to actually have the courage to have this difficult debate. And of course, the results were not prejudged. And of course, this shared conversation has really taken significant amount of time. And I firmly believe that this will help us as Christians to engage with those questions and not simply shy away from it and actually engage. And that's one of the things I really appreciate of the Archbishop, that he's not afraid, whether he's not determined by the failure and success of any situation, but rather a desire to help and engage and participate in those conversations.
Thank you. Perhaps we could stay with you, Anderson, and talk about your own particular role on the Archbishop's Committee for Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns. And this is another feature of the last 10 years. So really, the impetus after the George Floyd death in 2020 then caused a more concerted effort. I don't know if I'm right there seeing it in terms of tackling racism within the church. We had the debate about statues and memorials and so forth. But the way that the church has dealt with racism, actually, even after these new initiatives that were launched, is causing a lot of controversy and concern still. I mean, I don't want to talk too much because I'll leave the talking to you, but I was reading somewhere that there have been 5 different appointments for the head of the Independent Safeguarding Board. People keep leaving. So there's something going on somewhere about the work the church is tackling racism. So what's my question to you? How has Justin Welby done in terms of leading this initiative to tackle racism in the Church of England?
Well, racism, I think the problem is racism is not kind of 10 years or 20 years old. We're talking about human beings' desire to discriminate against each other. This is part of our human history and has been part of our Christian history in the last 2,000 years. So kind of you can't deal it in 10 years. But having said that, I think one of the biggest challenge was to how do we understand the systemic racism, systemic institutional problem of racial discrimination, ethnic discrimination. And that's where I was very very happy to be participant in that conversation. Just a small footnote, I no longer serve on the Archbishop's Council, but I was one of the authors of the Lament to Action report that worked on the Archbishop's task force. What we learned from Archbishop Justin is his deep desire to again respond. And I do remember having this conversation just when the Black Lives Matter movement was happening and the George Floyd's death has triggered global reaction. And I remember having a conversation with him and said, what is the Church of England doing? We have had the Archbishop's Commission, this committee for 30 years. Nothing has happened. More than 160 recommendations. We still have only one person of color in the senior leadership. And he honestly, candidly said, the task force that we are going to establish, just tell us what to do. And that real honesty and the desire to do something was taken up. And I'm very happy, you know, in the last 3 years, when we look back within the Church of England, in terms of senior leadership, we have gone from one bishop now to two diocesan bishops, 8 suffragan bishops, and more than 50 members within the General Synod, where I remember in 2017, I was the only person along with a couple of others. So there's a radical change. But of course, we are talking about theology. We are talking about our very understanding of Christianity, where racial inferiority, discrimination is so deeply embedded. And that takes time. But what I would certainly appreciate is that the commitment to do something, and I will give this one example. Most recently, when we talked about our colonial past, which is coupled with our racist past, the first thing that we came across was the role of church commissioners and the Queen Anne's bounty, which is connected to slave trade. And that determination, which I found in Archbishop Justin, was that desire to push the Archbishop's Council to commit that we are not actually going to simply talk about it, but actually commit. You know, this was taken up through the synod, and the both archbishops now have committed through the church commissioners £100 million to do reparatory work. How it's going to shape, we don't know. But that desire to do something is much appreciated. And this will be a trigger, an instigator for deep institutional change. And that's going to take a long time.
Thank you for that assessment. And another issue that's occupied the headlines, certainly about the Church of England in the last decade, is safeguarding. So we had the ICSA report that made recommendations, said that the church was too concerned with its own reputation. We've had these extraordinary stories of John Smythe in 2017, Jonathan Fletcher, 2020, Bishop Peter Ball. It's these huge stories about abuse by clergy and others within the church that he's had to deal with and answer. So, Professor Helen King, this is probably something for you. Safeguarding, I mean, it was there before he came in 2013, but it seems to have really taken a life of its own to the extent of dwarfing other concerns that that the church leadership has over the last 10 years. Would you agree with that? Was it the most difficult thing that he had to deal with over the last 10 years?
I think it's a very difficult thing for anyone to deal with, because admitting that the church is corrupt is not something you want to do, is it? Especially as Archbishop. And what's happened in the last 10 years, of course, is the ICSA, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse hearings, which were damning of the Church of England, of individuals who knew about abuse and did not report it, of abuse, of organised abuse. The Chichester Diocese story was particularly unpleasant. You know, a circle of priests passing people around between them. It's absolutely horrendous. And I don't think anything has been quite as disgusting as this to me in the way the church has treated people. And if you can't be safe in the church from this, then what on earth is the church doing? And yes, a lot of money has been put into safeguarding. Yes, now everyone at parish level who's involved in pretty well anything from PCC membership onwards will do safeguarding courses, and the courses have improved. They've become much more realistic about what actually happens if you think someone in your parish is doing something they shouldn't and how you report that. And that has become a really strong aspect at local level. But at national level, I'm still not convinced. The reports are still delayed. The John Smythe report that you mentioned is now over 1,000 days late in terms of when it was supposed to be produced. And of course, that one is very relevant because Justin Welby knew John Smythe and they were friends. And so there are questions there about what he personally knew about Smythe's abuse and how that was handled. And that's why abuse is still, to me, the really, really scary aspect of the last 10 years. Who is implicated? We know people didn't report things because they thought it was easier not to. We know now that you should report, otherwise people go on abusing, as Smythe did when he was moved to Africa. There are other reports which are late. There's also the redress scheme to help survivors. The redress scheme was supposed to be ready a year ago, and nothing's happened. There's the audit of Lambeth Palace safeguarding that was published very recently, and that was absolutely damning. So if people were not safe in Lambeth Palace, where were they safe?
Well, I wonder what accounts for that. What's your is this a failure of leadership? Is it a failure of organisational structure? Is it an unwillingness to confront the reality of what's going on? Why is the church so bad at sorting this out when schools and so forth have done such a good job of turning the situation round?
There are many, many related factors here, but partly it is the sort of purple circle, as it's been called, that archbishops and bishops tend to just cluster together, protect each other. You don't want to let down someone else who's one of you. And I think that's really unpleasant. You don't want to bring the church into disrepute by admitting that these things happen. But they do happen. If you don't admit it, you'll then bring the church into much more disrepute later on when it all comes out. There are other issues like the church's attitude to homosexuality. So because that's been taboo for so long and you couldn't admit if you were gay, therefore you wouldn't admit that you'd been abused, because you might think if it was someone of the same sex who'd abused you that somehow meant that you were tainted in some way and you were revealing your own sexuality, which you didn't want to. And there's all sorts of really complicated things going on in there. But the basic line here is that people were not safe and that the church did not do anything about it. We knew that was true of the Catholic Church. And in the last 10 years, we found out how very true it's been in the Church of England too.
Just reflecting on all the issues we've discussed so far, I'm wondering how you think that Justin Welby is handling the look, if you like, the reputation of the Church of England within the nation, and what we've got the global Anglican communion solemnities stick to the nation. So here we have a church out of step on issues of sexuality, unable to get its act together on safeguarding, slow on racism, with falling membership, declining income. What's a man like Justin Welby meant to do, leading an organisation like that, Paul Bayes?
I agree with what Helen has said about the parlous state of safeguarding within our church, but as she was talking, I was just reflecting on the immediate response of the Metropolitan Police to the report that came out, I think, earlier today or perhaps yesterday, where immediately the point guy, the guy in charge, was resisting some of the report and saying, "Oh no, we're not institutionally racist." I think that's a loaded political word. I have to say that the present Archbishop has never done that. He's always attempted to say to the nation, "We know that we're not a perfect church, and we're very sorry." And I think and occasionally for his own mistakes, he's had to apologise. But what I've not seen. I do agree that the deference within the church and the sense in which the leaders of the church can club together and the reputation of the institution becomes more important than anything else. I do agree that that is human, and the humanity of the church means that it's fallen into those pitfalls. But the Archbishop has not led that and has frequently repented for it publicly. That means that what people frequently see is an archbishop who's apologising. And I've heard people say, you know, can't he stop saying sorry? To which the answer is, well, he can stop saying sorry when there are no further things to say sorry about. But here's a leader who has been prepared to speak words of regret and repentance and sorrow. I know that the survivor community in the context of abuse does not believe that that's been sufficiently done, but I do want to underline the readiness of the Archbishop to step up and to admit fault.
How do you think he's gone down in the country as a whole, Bishop? So, I mean, the, outside the Church of England, it's been a turbulent decade. You have Brexit, five prime ministers, had the death of the Queen, we've got the coronation coming up, we've had COVID, we've had lockdowns. How do you think history will assess him as a leader on the public stage in England?
I think partly the I mean, this is not a man, you know, he's not, as it were, the Boris Johnson of the Christian Church. He doesn't pose with a larger than life personality because of his own class background and because of his own personal style. He is self-deprecating. He will frequently say, you know, goodness knows what, why I'm in this job. My own view is that there are very few, if any, who could do the job as well as he's doing it. But it is not his job, as it were, single-handedly to rescue the mission of the Church of God. You know, God is in charge, and what we have to try to do is get with God's program. I think what people will remember, I mean, we're talking about the guy as if he's retiring, but he's not, as far as I know. What people will remember from his first 10 years is someone who did his best in a new social context in terms of the media to be honest and real with people and to communicate that honesty and reality. Other archbishops before him have done the same, but he has not presented as a kind of lordly, larger than life, a nostalgic kind of bishop. And in that sense, he's very similar to the present pope. And he and the present pope, as we know, have an excellent working relationship and a personal friendship. And I think that's because between them, they understand the need to be human in these extremely inhuman jobs.
Thank you. There's a question in the chat box here about climate change as well. And I don't know which of you would like to take that question from Jenny Brown, who says that interested to hear the panel's views on the Archbishop's engagement in global issues, mm-hmm. including the climate crisis, inequality, and poverty. I wonder if any of you have any reflections. Yes, Anderson.
Yeah. No, this is simply because I've been working on this, so I could. I think one of the things that Bishop Paul said is that I think we will remember Archbishop Justin as the one of the bishops who really apologized a lot of times. That matters in the global context as well. I think he's one of the first archbishops to apologize in the Canadian context, and most recently apologizing for the abuses that have been committed under the kind of Anglican mission work to the Indigenous communities. He did the same in Australia. He did the same in New Zealand. He did the same in many African countries, and he, maybe most of us will remember him kind of falling flat face down in Jallianwala Bagh in Punjab, where the slaughter was conducted. So he does understand the global context and the role of the church, and also he deeply struggles with the history and the legacy of the empire, and he's not afraid to question those fundamental aspects. And this is where I've been engaging most recently. I think one of the critical things, I think we do hear a lot of noise from the Anglican Communion, particularly in the last couple of months. But it's very important to remind that more than 38 provinces, which he has been personally interacting with, hasn't made those kind of very drastic statements made by some of the primates within the Anglican Communion. And that is down to a large extent, his ability to negotiate behind the doors, his ability to speak to people in person. One of the examples of that was, again, what is happening in Sudan. For example, he was able to work with the Pope to bring two of the very difficult communities to bring into a conversation. And this, again, has a huge climate a reality, because he was again very instrumental in helping the formation of what is called the Green Anglicans, one of the groups that works across the Anglican Communion. And more than 70% of Anglicans in the global context are directly impacted by climate change. And he was, as a leader, prioritized that within the communion conversations to give importance to climate change. So I think There are. I'm not glorifying the Archbishop, but actually he has done quite a lot with regards to the communion, and that is one of the reasons I still believe the communion can hold on, despite the voices that are quite divided on the issue of human sexuality.
Interesting. See how that goes. There's another question in the box, but before I go to that question from you, Tim, Deepak, you've got your hand up.
I can say as a Hindu that, you know, in our places of worship, we have difficulty attracting young people for a variety of reasons, okay? But when you go to attendance and all this kind of thing, you know, I think most faiths, maybe not one particular one, are struggling. And we all need to do our own reflection in terms of how we serve better the younger generation and include them and serve them and et cetera. So that's one of the things.
Just questioning him, what kind of leader would you like him to have been? What would you like him to have done?
Well, I just feel that in the last 20, 30 years, the Anglican Church has withdrawn. And in the last 10 years, I can honestly say to you that, you know, the Anglican Church and their various representatives, the Dean, the Archbishop in Coventry or, you know, West Midlands, they're no longer present in these kinds of dialogue and these kinds of positions. And that's a shame for me, because I think I do need them to be included. And present and taking part and everything else. And it could be that they're, you know, funding and everything else. But I'm just saying to you that I have distinctively seen, and I'm a witness to that. And my last point to you, my friend, is around decolonization work. And I'm a board member of another organization that actually is doing something significant around that work. And when we heard of the £100 million that had been set aside or being proposed to be set aside, then there are, you know, two questions. One is that it's very low, to be totally honest with you. And secondly, how will that fund be, how will it be used? What will be done with it? You know, and how will it be ensured that people who have been affected or across the globe, you know, from all different communities, will benefit is the wrong word, but actually, you know, see the difference.
Thank you. Perhaps, Anderson, you could just pick up that point about the money.
The money-wise, I think that's the details of how that $100 million is going to be used is being discussed. And it was brought, I asked the same question in the General Synod that was passed in February, and the response was that the group is being brought together. So, but the key is, I think, of course, the whole work of reparation is a very big subject, and it's very easily we can go into a rabbit hole once we talk about reparation within the global history. But what is being tried or addressed is that how Church of England, with its acknowledgement of its complicitness within the historical process of colonization and slave trade, is willing to take a step to see where we want to help. And that's, I think it's going to be a very consultative process. And maybe quickly, I think, but I would push back on the question about Anglican engagement within the wider faith community. Is, I think, I've been part of various interfaith forums of Church of England, and I think we have actually become far more active in terms of our community engagement with other faith communities. So I would certainly, we do have a lot of folks within the Church of England who want to participate.
Thank you. Okay, I'll just go to Paul, Bishop Paul Bayes, just for our final contribution. There's a question in the chat box from Tim. Would the Church of England be better off if its leader was more personally charismatic, more powerful or engaging public figure, rather than self-deprecating, humble person that you have described? Does the declining church in a secularizing nation need a more dynamic leader to grab the country's attention once more? I wonder what your answer is to that.
Thank you. It's a great question, Tim. I think the answer is no. One of the things that we've not mentioned, it's been implicit in a lot of what we've said, is that because of the last 10 years, because of decline in membership, because of some confusions, because of the safeguarding issues, the church is anxious. We've become anxious. And when people are anxious, they look for a quick fix. Or they try and find the thing, the one thing that's going to make everything happy and everything work in any one place. And it may well be, you know, to Alison's point, it may well be that some of the investments in new ways of being the church carry that taint of anxiety with them. But one thing that I think we must not do is to think that that our anxiety should lead us to look for a Führer, you know, for someone who can rally the troops. Surely in the last few years politically, we've had enough of that, and of all this breast-beating populism. And I do think that self-deprecating humility is just that little bit closer to the example of the Lord Jesus Christ than the kind of strutting populism that you sometimes see in the American church, by which I don't mean any of the denominations in America. I mean the tele-evangelism in the United States, and I think there are those in this country who would only too readily step up and be big strong leaders. It seems to me that most of our problems come from precisely that. So the gentleness of the Archbishop's leadership is something that I think is entirely of the gospel.
Has he been very hurt by all these challenges and skirmishes that he's had to deal with? How does he cope?
It is an attritional job, and one of the things we've not talked about is the fact that one of the Archbishop's three priorities is prayer. Prayer, evangelism, reconciliation, and he has established in Lambeth Palace a community of prayer. Young people who give a year to pray together, others who contribute, but as it were, part time. He has spoken out consistently for the religious life within our Church of England, and I think much of that gives the guy his internal resources. But it would be idle to say that he's not been worn down, I think, by some of the role, as anybody is in any impossible job. And I do think one of the benefits of a gentle leader is that he's able to ask for help. One sees in the political world that if you apologize for anything, or if you admit that you might need a rest, all of a sudden people pile in and accuse you of not being perfect. And I'm sure that happens in the church too, but this Archbishop has not been afraid to admit that sometimes the job tires him out. And I think that because he admits it, he's able to cope with it.
Thank you. And thank you to all our panellists today for your contributions. You're quite right, Bishop. This isn't his resignation. It's simply the marking of the first 10 years. So who knows when that day will come. But thank you very much for your time, and look forward to seeing you at the next Religion Media Centre briefing. Thanks. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to the Religion Media Centre podcast. To find out more about us and what we offer, visit our website at religionmediacentre.org.uk. In the meantime, we look forward to welcoming you to our future podcast episodes.